I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Speaking today with Sean Chamberlain. Sean is the founder of the Dark Optimism site at darkoptimism.org and the author of The Transition Timeline for a Local Resilient Future. Welcome, Sean.
Hi.
I wanted to first note that the byline or the descriptor that you have on your website, Dark Optimism, is we are unashamedly positive about what kind of a world humanity could create and unashamedly realistic about how far we are from creating it. That, I think that's probably the one of the bylines that we could use for this program as well, Change Surfer Radio. So tell us first about the transition movement that you seem to be pretty centrally a part of.
Yeah, well, it started back in, I think, 2005 with a chap called Rob Hopkins, who was originally based in Ireland, but then moved across to England to a place called Totnes, which is where transition really kicked off. And it's basically local communities coming together in response to climate change and peak oil primarily. And rather than the two main things that seem to be advised people, which are A, you know, marching and protesting and asking governments to do something about it, or B, doing things as an individual, you know, flying less, driving less, changing light bulbs. It's about communities coming together, taking charge of their own future, and really building a positive vision of the future that we could see, even within the context of these challenges, and building resilience and happiness within local communities to face the times that we're in.
So this is partly a political challenge to Greens, who often have a very pessimistic and just say no to everything kind of public persona, right? And so you're trying to...
I'm not sure I'd call it a political challenge. It's certainly a challenge to... I mean, I would say that although there have been some very notable successes of the environmental movement, I think overall most environmentalists would agree that... generally, it's been a bit of a disaster so far. You know, the general trends in society aren't heading towards greater sustainability and a healthier biosphere. And I think, yeah, a big part of that is the negative visioning. I mean, what a classic example is this Earth Hour thing. I don't know how big that is in America. Certainly we have it over here, and I know some friends in Australia have said it's very big over there, where they have this hour where people sort of turn out all their lights and you know, reduce their energy usage and everything as a symbol of you know, awareness, but also as a practical way of actually, you know, reducing emissions to some extent. And to me, the messaging around that is completely backwards, because generally speaking, I think the majority of people see the lights going out as symbolic of disaster, you know. I mean, if you look at the energy companies' adverts, they're all about, hey, we're keeping the lights on, you know, we're keeping the home fires burning. And so for the sort of environmental movement to attach itself to let's turn the lights out across civilization for an hour, I think it's very much back to front. So yeah, transition, I wouldn't necessarily call it a political position, because transition is explicitly apolitical, really. But certainly we try to build that positive vision of a future that people actually, you know, makes them want to get out of bed in the morning and actually do something to create it, rather than saying, here's this awful place, let's all not go there together, which is a bit backwards.
I mean, that vision's been implicit in a lot of green thought and writing for a long time.
People
arguing that we could have a higher quality of life if we made some of these changes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was actually doing an interview a week or two ago, and the interviewer was actually saying that she's often confronted by sort of climate change deniers and the like. And she used to sort of go into a big argument about, oh, there's all this evidence and it's pretty clear and everything else. But now she just says, well, actually, even if we weren't causing climate change, this makes my life happier. This is more the kind of life I want to live. I want a life with a stronger sense of community. I want a sense of well-being and responsibility in myself. And, you know, even if climate change didn't exist, this would still be the kind of life I want to lead. So really, you know, your sort of denialist position almost leaves me cold, because this does appear to be, according to the scientific evidence, what we need to do to have any kind of desirable future. But it's also actually making us happier in the short term.
Well, let's talk about the four scenarios that you outline in your book, and I'll just give the name again for those who want to look it up, The Transition Timeline for a Local Resilient Future. And it's structured around four possible future scenarios, which is why it turns on future scenario builders like myself and Jimmy Cassio.
Yeah.
And the first is denial. Denial is basically we go on as usual.
Basically, we ignore the evidence of the sort of environmental and energy crises that we're facing, and carry on blindly. Yeah.
And so you're trying to look out 20 years ahead. What happens in 20 years if we don't make any significant changes?
Well, in that scenario, I think firstly, probably most crucially, we hit unstoppable runaway climate change. I think from memory, in 2016, in that scenario, although we don't necessarily realize it for a few years after that. And essentially what we see there is that the kind of cultural stories that we have around our future start to shift very dramatically when that becomes understood. There's firstly a sort of wave of anger and disbelief, and that's followed by a real sense of, apocalyptic. And the sense of, we're moving into the end times and there's no hope for, a better future for our children or anything else, and a great deal of recrimination and everyone out for themselves. And that's really one of the things that I focused on in the book, is looking at, the transition movement is very focused on peak oil and climate change, but I think what's not asked quite so often about those things is what's actually the cause of climate change and peak oil. And I wouldn't say the cause is, nature having created too many fossil fuels or too few fossil fuels or whatever. It's much more a consequence of our collective choices as a species. And I think it's these cultural stories that we tell ourselves about what's important to us and what kind of future we can expect that really shapes the kind of choices that we collectively make. And so that's what I've tried to focus on in each of the four scenarios, is how those stories shift and how they interact with what actually happens. So those stories shift and they in turn affect the reality, which in turn affects the stories. So it's a classic sort of feedback situation. So in the denial scenario, as I say, basically, ultimately things become so blindingly obvious that we're forced out of our denial and find we've ended up somewhere pretty undesirable.
I'm a sociologist, so for me, when you mention apocalypticism, that pings for me, because one of the things that I'm very attuned to is the way that American religious subculture is appropriating or responding to these various kinds of signs of the end times, as they see it, and that it fits into an eschatological narrative for them, which does not necessarily include any of the kinds of changes that we would like to see to get to a good place, because it's all preordained.
Absolutely. I mean, to quickly touch on the four scenarios that are in the book, I mean, you've got denial. Now, I've been thinking about what are the, I think three of these scenarios are basically the dominant narratives that exist in our culture around the future, and the fourth is really one that we're trying to create within the transition movement and beyond. And I was thinking about which sort of famous films or studies or stories really represent these, and I think the denial thing is probably the thing that came to mind. Actually, was sort of government planning documents, which sort of assume that the future will be basically like today, with maybe a bit more of everything, but basically that's how it's going to pan out. And then the second scenario is the one which is very much based around, these apocalyptic stories and, things like The Age of Stupid, a film that's come out recently, which looks at where we're headed if we don't wake up, and, shows a kind of world falling into unstoppable climate change. And then you've got what the scenario I call the impossible dream, which is basically the, techno fix. Science will solve everything. We really don't need to make any changes in our lifestyle as long as we keep faith with technology. And I was thinking maybe something like Star Trek is that, that we, science overcomes all and we go off exploring the stars and there's no sort of fundamental energy challenge here. And then the fourth vision, which is our sort of transition vision, which is of the sort of localized, more resilient future, as you mentioned in the subtitle. We were really struggling to come up with that. We thought maybe, I don't know if Wallace and Gromit, I suspect, is quite an English thing. I don't know if that's made it over to America.
Oh, absolutely.
Has it? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, we were thinking maybe that's as close as we could come to a sort of mainstream depiction of the future, which is, you know, that has lots of appropriate technology in it, but is very much, you know, localized, people growing their own food, people, you know, working together as communities. But it pretty much stands alone, I think, and even that's maybe a bit of a stretch. So what we really want to see is that narrative coming through as an alternative to the, you know, denial or apocalypse or techno-fix type narratives, which seem to very, very much dominate in the mainstream mainstream media and mainstream perception.
I'd say my audience is probably most interested in the techno-fix. So the kinds of questions that we're interested in are how plausible are ramping up nuclear energy, space-based mm-hmm. solar, various kinds of nanotechnology-based yeah. Conservation and solar innovations and so forth. So mm-hmm. but you don't see that as a path that could yield sufficient amounts of climate conservation.
Well, I suppose I've started asking a slightly different question. I mean, I've been sort of working on peak oil in particular, but certainly peak oil and climate change since about 2000. And coming into that world then, back in the days of, for those who know, Jay Hansen's dieoff.org and Colin Campbell's work around peak oil, the questions were really then, you know, is there anything else that we can really ramp up to fill the gap? And yeah, I did a lot of work on that. I mean, I edited a book called The Lean Guide to Nuclear Energy, which essentially concluded that it looks like nuclear energy, for example, becomes an energy sink within about a decade, even at current rates of use, because of the depletion of high-quality uranium. So, you know, if you take into account the whole life cycle, the mining, milling, processing, building of power stations, decommissioning of power stations, the whole thing actually takes more energy than it actually produces in useful electricity, and thus sort of puts us more into debt in terms of our energy and climate issues. And, of course, nuclear isn't carbon-free if you take into account the whole life cycle. It's only the actual fission part that's carbon-free. So, you know, I got quite into that sort of technical wonkishness, if you like, of looking at all these options and trying to figure out which one could fill the gap. And I suppose if I was looking at techno-fix, I find concentrating solar power quite an exciting thing, and as you say, nano-solar. But I think, to my mind now, there's a deeper question, which is a sort of a cultural shift that we need, because say, for example, that say concentrating solar power could produce, it can't, but let's say it could produce unlimited, unmeterably cheap, completely clean, no issues at all, huge supplies of energy. Well, although our sort of environmental minds have been trained very much on climate change recently, if you take such an unlimited, clean, wonderful source of energy and plug it into our existing society, you don't get sustainability. What you get is a culture which is, you know, has all manner of environmental problems, some of which have sort of been swept under a carpet a bit by climate change. And you provide it with an unlimited energy source, which isn't necessarily good news for everybody. And so what's really interesting me is looking at the sort of underlying stories that are leading us to these kind of paths. So, for example, things like the growth paradigm that a lot of people are talking about now, and the idea that, you know, that it's even possible to technologically replace our existing energy sources with sort of, you know, renewable, unlimited ones, and consequently carrying on growth. Then you get into much more probably philosophical questions about what is growth and how do we define it, and, you know, is it desirable, and is growth something that ends? I mean, in nature, most organisms grow and reach a state of maturity. Is unending growth actually a desirable thing? And so it's these kinds of cultural perspectives that I think are the reason why I called that scenario the impossible dream, because it seems to me that it's the idea that, well, we can just carry on as we are as long as we have the right technological solution. And someone, I can't remember who it was, someone said once, you can't solve today's energy problems with tomorrow's new technologies. And I think that's very relevant there as well. The original sort of thinking of peak oil, which was how can we find another energy source to continue with business as usual, is a bit outdated by the fact that business as usual isn't actually bringing us much that we want. It isn't actually. There's this very strong cultural story of progress, that this is the most advanced civilization that's ever existed, when in fact, you know, we've got incredibly high mental health problem rates, we've got incredibly high depression rates, we've got immense environmental challenges, whereas, you know, other cultures have existed for millennia without creating these kind of challenges. So it's very hard to actually quantify the sense in which this is the most advanced society in the world, other than some sense of technical, technological understanding. So so I suppose my perspective has shifted much more to the kind of questions of cultural stories as sort of wisdom rather than intelligence, rather than are we capable of creating energy from some other source. The question really is, do we actually want to do that? Is that actually producing the kind of life that we want to lead?
I'm speaking with Sean Chamberlain about his book, The Transition Timeline for a Local Resilient Future, and you can find out more about that at darkoptimism.org. When we talk about shifting to a steady state global economy, mm-hmm. obviously that takes some change in the way that we approach economics and sustainable growth. But we're probably going to have sustainable population by the middle of this century. Is your vision of a transition, does it necessarily require radical reductions in population? In other words, lots of people dying.
Yeah, no, I think basically it requires a gradual reduction in population. So it requires, again, a shift in our sort of cultural perspectives on it, so that, in the section of the timeline which looks at population, within the UK, we're looking at, for example, the SOAPs here, which SOAPs presumably is a word that applies in America as well, of these sort of programs which follow people's ordinary lives. And I think these things are very important in forming the sort of the cultural perspectives that we have. People look to them to see, you know, how people live their lives and what's normal and what's acceptable in terms of behavior. And so one thing we're trying to do in the UK is talk to the producers of the massive soap operas that we have here and try and infiltrate stories like a family, you know, querying whether they should have more children in light of the environmental situation and things like this, so that actually, you know, we can have a population which is gradually reducing, but without that happening through misery. I don't know if you've come across Kenneth Boulding wrote, what did he call it, his Dismal Theorems. Have you come across
that? No, I haven't, no.
He basically said that if the only ultimate check on the growth of population is misery, then the population will grow until it is miserable enough to stop growing, which he followed up with his utterly dismal theorem, I think he called it, which is that any technical improvement, any improved technology, only relieves misery for a while. So for as long as misery is the only check on population, any technological improvements will basically just allow a larger population to be sustained in misery. So you've got a larger equilibrium population. And so from this, he concluded with, I think he called it the moderately cheerful form of the dismal theorem, which was that we have to find something else, basically, other than misery and starvation, which can keep a prosperous population in check, so that we can have a form of steady state population, I suppose.
But don't we already have that in the form of female empowerment? I mean, isn't that the principal driver of the demographic transition that's occurring in the developing world? When women get educated.
That's a big question. I mean, absolutely, it's an absolutely central thing, and that is totally one of the drivers that does keep population in check. Absolutely, I think there are others, but without going into a massive conversation on population, which I'm sure we could have, I think essentially the vision within transition of population is that yes. Clearly, it does need to be limited, and the sooner we can do that, the better. And so our sort of work around that is basically around trying to make people more aware of the impacts of population growth, and particularly developed world population growth, because you often hear people talking about population growth as a developing world problem, or a majority world problem, as I would tend to say. But, of course, I don't know the figures exactly for the U.S., but I know in the U.K., every UK birth is responsible for around 35 times more greenhouse gas emissions and environmental damage than a new birth in Bangladesh, and I think 150 times a birth in Ethiopia. So
we're worse.
Figures, the population growth here has a much bigger environmental impact than population growth in the majority world. And I think these kind of changes in perception, where people start to see this as our problem and something that we can actually do something about in our personal lives, will help with that transition to a sustainable population, which A, can hopefully happen sooner and hopefully at a lower population, which of course, I don't agree with people who say that population is the key environmental problem, but it clearly is a multiplier for, you know, huge numbers of environmental problems. And so really our vision, I mean, one of the transition concepts is that we don't claim to have the answers to everything. We're just communities working together to address these things. And so our perspective is not so much, you know, let's run the figures and figure out what kind of population is sustainable, so much as what can we do to improve the situation. And we feel that what we can do to improve the situation is to raise awareness, raise that kind of thinking, so that the population problem gets, or the population contribution to our problems gets a little bit better, basically.
Hmm. Well, it doesn't sound like you're advocating for any like licensing of parenting or anything like that.
No, absolutely not. Essentially, it's about it's about responsibility in communities, and basically recognizing that that our actions have consequences, and that's one of the things that laying out these four future scenarios has really helped with, is that people can see, well, actually, all of these look vaguely plausible, and I can see how we could lead down any of them. So let's pick the one that we want, and then sort of ask ourselves, how do we get there? And that creates a sort of an action plan, if you like, the backcasting process of deciding where we want to be, and then figuring out, let's assume we get there, how do we do it, and let's get going.
You've been advising the UK government on something called personal carbon allowances. Is this like a cap and trade system for individuals?
No. Yes and no. personal carbon allowances is what the UK government call it, because they don't want to go anywhere near the word rationing. But essentially, the scheme that I've been working on and advocating is called tradable energy quotas. It was developed by a guy called Dr. David Fleming at the Lean Economy Connection. And it's essentially energy rationing. So I know in the UK we've got a target of 80% emissions reductions by 2050. And I believe Obama's talking about a similar target for the US. I don't know if it's actually law yet or the like. But
no.
But essentially we don't as yet have any structured system for making that happen. and so what tradable energy quotas would do is essentially take that carbon budget, that carbon trajectory, and convert it into basically carbon rate all energy. So it would, you know, both be based on the amount of carbon emitted by a litre of fuel or a kilowatt of electricity, depending on which source it came from, etc. And then there would be a ration of energy quantified in terms of emissions given out to, yes, every person in the country, but also every organisation in the country, including the government themselves and all business and farming and everything. So individuals would get their rations free. Companies, organisations of all kinds would have to buy theirs at an auction. And this, of course, guarantees then that the carbon budget is actually achieved, because there's no way that anyone can use energy in the economy without having some of these rations available.
Google's working on a system of energy metering, so hooking up with electricity companies to have web-based energy metering so you can keep track of...
Well, not necessarily. I mean, one of the beauties of the scheme is that it doesn't require any more information than is already collected. You know, you don't have to measure the emissions on every car and every factory or whatever else, because energy flows through the economy. So all that's required is the information on how much primary energy is sold, so fuel and electricity, basically. And then because that energy is being carbon rated, that then tells you how many rations are required, how many tradable energy quotas are required. And so then that flows through the whole system, because if you wanted to, say, go and buy a table, you wouldn't have to surrender any rations for that. And so you might think, well, what about the embodied energy in the table? But, of course, the manufacturer of the table has had to buy their rations to cover the energy that was used in the purchase of it, and so they'll have to pass that on in the price of the table. So one of the beauties of the scheme is that it does cover all energy and emissions within the whole economy, but it actually only requires monitoring of direct sales of fuel and electricity. And, of course, that information is already held, because companies or individuals selling fuel or electricity need to know how much they're selling in order to charge their customers. We are actually looking at a tie-in with a group called AME, AMEE, which actually stands for the Avoidance of Mass Extinctions Engine. And that's basically a system of creating a sort of energy rating system for all occurrences within the economy, within society, and also provides the sort of personal carbon account functionality, which would obviously be required for people to manage their budget, their ration. But it, as I say, it doesn't actually lead to a requirement for additional monitoring or carbon labelling or any of these kinds of concepts. It provides a very straightforward way of implementing a strict carbon budget.
Not sure I'm totally understanding all of that, but we only have time for one more question. I wanted to ask you about how geoengineering or discussion of direct management of the climate, for instance, putting aerosols into space in order to... So I wonder how that fits into your vision of a transition.
Right, okay. I'll just say on tradable energy quotas, it's if people want more information on that, it's www.tex.net, which is TEQS. That's the acronym of tradable energy quotas.net. But yeah, geoengineering is a big question, of course. I think that there are huge areas of geoengineering which I would sort of write off pretty quickly. I mean, things like basically reducing the insulation of the Earth, so, you know, putting mirrors in space or increasing the reflectivity of the oceans or putting aerosols in the air seem a bit of a non-starter on the basis that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is causing a lot of problems other than climate change, a key example, of course, being the acidification of the oceans and all the damage that is doing. So if we don't manage to remove CO2 from our atmosphere, if we combine that with reducing the input of solar energy, well, firstly, we don't obviously know what all the implications of that would be, but secondly, we haven't actually dealt with all the problems that the increasing CO2 concentration is causing. Having said that, you know, there are other kinds of geoengineering, like attempting to draw down CO2 directly from the atmosphere via various sort of synthetic trees and all sorts of various other things. I tend to think what's lacking here, again, I come back to the sort of underlying cultural stories, and it seems to me there is this idea here that we have this amazing technological ability, and that if we can take this problem, we can isolate it, we can solve it, and then, you know, we can apply that to the world, and we'll have dealt with the problem. And someone said once the chief cause of problems is solutions, and I get that feeling around a lot of this thinking. It's that would all be great if this were the first technological thing ever put into existence which had no unforeseen side effects, but of course it won't be. And also a lot of these geoengineering things, having talked to a number of climate scientists and engineers, they seem to be, they're sort of blue sky thinking. You know, people are saying, well, this is a really serious problem. What could we potentially do about it? Very few of them are actually in a position where they're sort of ready to be deployed on any kind of timescale that's relevant to the kind of timescale that the climate scientists are telling us we're facing on the possibility of runaway climate change. So generally speaking, I would say that the key priority is not saying, well, you know, what's our carbon emissions target by 2050, or maybe we can introduce this geoengineering. The key thing is, what can we do in the next few years to dramatically reduce our emissions? And ultimately, as the climate science tells us, reduce concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere from what they are now, let alone slow down the increase in emissions. And so geoengineering, I think, it may have to have a role, because the climate situation is so urgent now that it may be necessary that we put into place some geoengineering style things. But if we do that in place of making the dramatic changes in our society that are required, then we don't really stand a chance. If we do it as a supplement to the dramatic changes that are required, then maybe there's a role for it. But I'm pretty wary when it comes to geoengineering.
Sean, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I urge everyone to take a look at your blog at darkoptimism.org. There are a lot of resources linked from there, including links to the new book, The Transition Timeline for a Local Resilient Future. And thanks for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Our opening and closing music was composed and recorded by Ricardo Campa. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.